see her.
I'll raise it another 100.
200 to see. Okay.
I fold.
Same here. Ain't sandbagging me.
I'll raise it 200. Say, boy. You're trying to force me to draw, ain't you? I know your system. And I know you're supposed to try and kill me. But I'm not losing my temper of that, I'm sure. If anybody draws first, it's gotta be you.
Do you expect me to talk?
Hello and welcome to episode 232 of Do You Expect Us to Talk. I'm Becca, and this time we're trapped between two killers in a snowy landscape with my co-host Chris Byrne and Dave Bond. How are you both?
Good evening, folks.
Good evening, everybody.
We also have a third.
I was tempted just to say nothing there, just in honour of the protagonist.
Oh, I see. All right. I thought you meant because like Gary Lineker didn't go on air last night. I'm not going to speak.
It's just going to be mute.
I'm going to protest like about a person who I couldn't really care less about. Yeah.
That's going to really date this show. That's going to really date this show.
Well, also, it could be worse. Could we start talking about Des Lynam?
DC Des. Careful.
I think after the whole Gary Lineker debacle, I think people were kind of thinking, oh, what's Des Lynam up to? Can we defrost him?
He's about 80 now. And I don't
Is he still going?
He's still alive, but I think he pretty much retired at the end of the 90s.
He was probably relishing the chance.
Didn't he do Countdown?
Yeah. I forgot about that. Yes, he did it for a while, but he was commuting to do it, so he only did it for a few months. The strange thing about him, right, is until the last few years where Lineker has genuinely nailed it, he's the most relaxed presenter I've ever seen.
Like, he's very chill, isn't he?
Yeah, it never looked like he was presenting, right? But he went to like ITV and suddenly looked really tense. And then I saw him on Countdown once and he looked really uncomfortable on that as well. It's like he lost his mojo completely.
After not presenting a sports show in smooth style.
Could be that.
Anyway, also introducing our epic film music expert, Charlie Brigden. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Is he epic? Is the music expert? Or is it epic? Or his expertise is the epic bit?
Just everything. I'm confused. Generally, we are all epic. Thanks. I just thought, oh, I forgot to introduce Charlie as we're getting diverted to you speaking about Gary Lineker and the epic fallout.
Yes, welcome to Match of the Day.
Yeah, they'll get to us eventually. They're going down the list of people saying no. Because the thing is, they did it without any commentaries and stuff like that. And then the
it was
immediate...
20 minutes, wasn't it?
No,
it
was but the immediate... Forget that, right? Because you've always got people who don't like him who go, it's better this way. But the immediate reaction was, that's just failed every accessibility standard there is.
Yeah,
you've just put silent football on. What's the point of that?
Might as well just go and watch the real thing. I don't know. But yeah, no, it's spectacularly shot them in the foot and it's just sort of gone the way that nobody would expect. And it's just ridiculous. It's just...
So, as a desperate reach, Match of the Day was silent last night.
I like to think it was honour of our podcast of the film we're covering today.
Yeah. He was probably listening last night, or a couple of days ago.
What, with Samuel L. Jackson?
With Samuel L. Jackson, and the Queen's Court. Of the Queen now as well. Ronnie's tried it on with her a couple of times, there you go. Right?
Oh
so
my God.
He's tried it on, and Gary's having a listen, and he gets the good, the bad, and the ugly, and he's all ready to watch Once Upon a Time in the West. He sees The Great Silence. He's like, I've not seen this. Oh. He's like, shit, and I've got Match of the Day to do tomorrow. Let's get online and call the Tories some cunts. That'll get me out of it. I can watch it ready for what they think.
my gosh.
They are cancer.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, they are gets generally.
No disagreement for me.
Not at the moment. The most Tory people I know are going like, bloody hell.
Let's all remain really impartial.
Right, let's stay off it now because we don't do politics.
It's been quite impartial. We all just agreed on something.
Yeah, I know.
Well, exactly.
I know, but we haven't done politics since the early days, but we had to give it away there.
Yeah, so we're talking about a film that's inspired by Malcolm X and Che Guevara.
Yeah, and yeah, Gary Lineker.
No politics.
No, that's it. It's a highly political film, politically charged. By, you know, sort of leaders of revolutions whose deaths helped their cause. And no, we're not political at all.
It's very much like Gary Lineker. It's like, you know, you fall on your sword and it's like, you know, it's like the sacrificial lamb, isn't it?
When you say fell on his sword, that's not a euphemism. He didn't fall over with a stiffy, did he?
No, it's not.
Okay.
I mean, he might have to be now. I have no idea, but, you know, I don't know anything about his personal life.
As Ted
Tanson fell off his chair. We don't know.
I'm 8 seasons into a rewatch of Cheers and he hasn't fallen off his chair yet. And it's a bloody comedy. He's got a chair in his office and he's naturally a bit lazy and loose. You'd think he'd fall off his chair once, wouldn't you?
We need to write to him and say, look, is there a scene where he falls off his chair?
Well, I wrote to Robert Darby and he didn't know.
Oh, no. Robert Darby.
Okay. No, but you've heard of some rumours, though, hasn't he? That's what I think that's what you alluded to.
Definitely. Well, it's like we're watching. I just had on a Crufts, obviously the dog show at the moment. Best in show this evening. The live stream, and obviously big supporters in the States and other countries too. And obviously they have to honour like big supporters of the show. Obviously they've had Chelsea Pensioners. But a lot of people were like, who are they? What do they do? You know, why are they called? It's like need to explain this to a foreign audience, which is fair enough.
You would have to explain it to most of the British audience, to be fair. Our knowledge of our own culture is quite weak.
They live in the Chelsea Hospital. it's just one of those things, isn't it? It kind of goes both ways. I mean, yeah, we do. Majority of our listeners are across the pond, so there's probably quite a lot that we have to explain on
it. It's just you realise how low our educational standards are in that, like, every time my wife asks someone how you spell something, she's taught, because she's Romanian, yeah? She's taught it wrong. You're in your and there and everything else. I've had to like deprogram
her.
Loose and lose and stuff like that. Every single one of them, I've had to deprogram her for being taught it the wrong way by helpful Brits who can't fucking spell.
Is it the wrong way? It's just a different way, isn't it? You know.
No, I suppose it's wrong.
No, it's wrong. Sir.
Well, I'm sorry. There are three different versions of there, and they all mean different things.
Yeah,
you can't go well. However,
We should perhaps just learn it. Perhaps I'd know the American way or other ways, for example. Anyway.
Well, to be fair, they are taught American English. So her cousin's husband did walk into a shop and he was asked about money, and he said, "It's in my pants." And this Cornish person looked at him like, "Oh my God, some illegal immigrant's going to flash at me."
No.
He was neither illegal nor going to flash, but this is a very white area.
No. So, yeah. Although, having said that, I know when I was once engaged to this American guy, I worked for kind of helped out a little bit for a while because his parents owned a gas station, a petrol station. Obviously, I didn't work because I was in there on a student visa, but I sort of helped out. A little bit sort of manning whilst he wasn't there sort of thing. And the amount of people who would pay, like, by instead of having like a purse or a wallet or something, like out of the bra or
yeah.
It's just like, I don't want to touch that. And obviously working over here in the shop, I've had various, you know, worked for most of the big name retailers on the high street. It doesn't happen half as much over here as it does over there. I'm just sort of like, unless you know, I was like, I don't want any money or cash that you have to give me. It's come out of your bra. And I'm like, no, thank you, love.
Well, my wife used to work in a cash centre and they used to have to wear gloves and kind of handle all the money that came through from cash machines and stuff. And the ones that had been rolled up and had various substances inside.
Oh, no, really?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
And all kinds of things.
It's so dangerous, isn't it? It really is, because you don't know. You literally don't know where it's been.
Mm. Yeah, exactly.
And yeah, you kind of you put yourself... open to so many dodgy stuff. Oh my God. Bloody hell. I think we should start a separate podcast about all our cultural experiences rather than about film.
I don't think I've got much cultural experience, quite frankly.
You've been to Sale Town Hall?
I haven't. I'm sure you could tell me some stories. I'm sorry to have missed out on the big day there.
Yeah, it was a lovely room. And that's pretty much it.
Well, I'm learning.
Yes, I'm learning lots.
Becca, what are we covering tonight?
We've been recording for about, 20, 25 minutes, and it's just like, oh my God.
I think our podcast works better when we just do ramble on, I think, quite frankly.
Don't talk about the film.
Yes, but this is the section of the podcast I'd like to refer to as paying lip service to the title of the podcast.
Yeah, literally. Quite literally. So, yeah, I apologise for Lance for mangling.
We're doing a shit job because we're nothing but talking for the past.
Well, that's because you expect us to talk.
What are we supposed to do? Interpretive dance?
Interpretive dance doesn't go very well for a non-visual medium. But yes, tonight we had discussed. Excuse me. So yes, we are discussing Charlie's Request, and I'm so glad that he recommended it. It's The Great Silence, starring more names that I'm going to mangle, so I can only apologise.
Herzog a lot, some French dude, and
Klaus Kinski, who is amazing, Frank Wolf, whose name I can pronounce without problems, and Vanessa McGee in a debut role. Original score by Ennio Morricone. Story by Sergio Corbucci. Screenplay by Vittoriano Petrilli, Mario Amendola, and many more. And directed by Sergio Corbucci and released in 1968.
What I love is you are incredibly nervous of pronouncing anything until it comes to an Italian, and then you throw yourself in the gusto and really do it in a sing-song way. And you go, it's Jean...
Jean Junior.
A French man. And then it's Sergio Corbucci!
Well, if you're going to do it, you might as well go all in.
She's not that confident with English names.
No. Frank Wolf, I can say his name.
Tom, did I say that right? Tom?
I've literally... Obviously, being dyslexic and trashing the rest of it, I'm like, I want to get it right, but I've literally just copied the way Charlie wrote it earlier. I've literally written... So I thought, well, hopefully that's how I can pronounce, so I can apologise for any fans of French cinema. If we ever come to do any sort of, a New Wave film or... anything like that, then I can only apologise.
Oh,
I'm just going to mangle your names. Likewise, if we ever do any sort of...
I'll just say, look it up on the Wikipedia on their... go to IMDb, there you are.
Yeah,
I'll just... All we said to Becca, right, and this does work, if you take his name, say any three-letter words in a strong three-syllable word that begins with a T...
In a French accent.
In a French accent, and end it with something that vaguely rhymes with filet mignon, you're going to be roughly right. It's not difficult.
Yeah, I mean, I've always said when you're trying to get pronunciation, it sounds dead stupid.
Yeah.
But if you just do like your own French accent, it does actually work. You do get the pronunciation right. Yeah, and it sounds daft. It sounds almost like insulting to go like sort of like all this kind of thing like ouais, But if you start doing a French accent,
welcome to Language Skills with Chris Byrne.
Welcome to Translate French 101.
Yeah, but I think a lot of people struggle with it because they try and do it in their own dialect, and it's doesn't quite work.
In their own dialect.
And obviously we've got English, and then we've got regional accents on top of that. But obviously you get them, wherever you go.
Filet mignon, innit?
Sorry, Jean-Louis Trentignard, Klaus Kinski, Frank Wolf. My Doris accent, my Wiltshire accent, top
okay,
of my chatter.
Okay, so that's The Great Silence.
Yes.
Charlie, tell us about why you...
What's that next week?
Yes, join in next week when we go back to try to pronounce Charles Bronson.
Yeah, don't let him out of jail. Oh my God. He's not allowed out. He needs to stay inside.
But it's okay. There's still some Italians in it for Becca to pronounce in a singing voice.
I probably mispronounced his name. So, yeah. Well, I couldn't pronounce Mario Amendola, so I must have pronounced that name. But I got Corbucci right, definitely. And I do know that any Italian names, you've got a C and H. If you've got the H, it makes the C like a hard sound, so it's not a ch, but it's a k sound. So I know that much.
Yeah, like Scarchi.
Yes.
Yeah. So
anyway, I'd like to put Charlie on the spotlight. Why The Great Silence? Why is it so great? Let us know your insights, please.
Well, we've talked previously when we did the Dollars trilogy about the what's called revisionist westerns, where you have kind of these films that are very non-traditional and subversive compared to what are considered the classic westerns, the kind of, you know, the ones where it's like the John Wayne against the cowboys and stuff, and you've got the white hat, black hat thing, and the sheriff and all that kind of thing. excuse me. So this film is just takes that and just subverts it in the most amazing way. And it's not even like, I mean, you can take bits of, even though the Dollars trilogy, particularly the second and third one, are so really brutal in places. Talking about last week about when Tuco gets his ass kicked by Lee Van Cleef, Angel Eyes, and his subordinate, and how brutal that was. And then it's kind of like in this film, it's you get that atmosphere and that mood for the whole film. It's, and again, it's set in the snow, so which is something you just, you barely see in westerns. And again, the traditional westerns is this arid, kind of dry American desert, and here you've got the snow, which again just makes it so kind of bleak and almost kind of nihilistic. And then bad word coming up, it's political as well, with the way it deals with the bandits who are really just kind of struggling, hungry for food. Meanwhile, you've got all these guys, the bounty killers, going around just kind of killing anyone. And it's kind of even the hero, so to speak, Silence, as in the name, yeah, Jean-Louis Trintignant. He's as much a ruthless savage killer as any of the others, and he does it for money as well. He does it for things, and it's just kind of the reputation he's kind of got about helping kind of people in need, as it were. It just kind of separates him apart, but he's still really, I mean, the way he kind of shoots people's thumbs off and stuff like that, tortures them and things. And again, it's this something that kind of comes back to a few dollars more, and we'll come back to when we watch another Once Upon a Time in America, Once Upon a Time in the West, is the idea of how traumatized these people are by previous events, and how revenge comes into things on both sides. And also, he's mute. He doesn't speak an entire word through the whole film, doesn't make a sound. So you've got him, and then opposite you've got Klaus Kinski, who's amazing, and who talks constantly. And he's got those big kind of blue, kind of almost Aryan eyes, and it just makes the most perfect villain. And without going into the ending, which obviously we'll discuss later, again, that's a massive subversion of the classic Western climax of kind of the hero versus the villain and all this kind of thing, and they're coming in, riding into town to save the day, and along with a beautiful, beautiful melancholy Ennio Morricone score. It's such a horribly beautiful film, and I think it deserves so much more recognition, and I prefer it to any of the Dollars trilogy, to be honest with you. I'm done.
I think that's thank you. I think that's a perfect way to describe it, horribly beautiful, because it is really bleak compared to
and really grim at the same time.
It is, definitely.
The score kind of
did that as well, because there was places where I was thinking, this is so much more melancholic than anything in the Dollars trilogy.
Mm.
And then I'd feel almost a grandeur in certain scenes. It's a very sort of, I couldn't think of the word. I can't even think of the word for the score.
It is like operatic and but, yes,
it's not big enough to be operatic in my mind.
It never goes that far. Like you said, it pulls back.
They got contrasted to more like sort of strings and trumpets
got,
and that.
It's got
like
strings and a bit of. I don't think it's xylophone, but you get the idea. It's got a bit of something like.
Yeah,
that,
it's got a bit something else like it's quite percussive compared to like how like the Dollars trilogy, how pared back or pared back in essence, how like. I don't know, animalistic? It's more kind of, not quite sure. Tribalistic, I'm not quite sure what the word is.
The catchy theme of the Western is an iconic part of the Western kind of film cinema landscape, and even down to the Dollars trilogy.
But then go and listen to his thinking of another Snow Western he was involved with. If you go and look at The Hateful Eight and the opening theme to that film, that is far heavier and more imposing than anything in this film. Almost like he felt the need there to say, this film's going to be quite foreboding, in a way that he didn't feel the need to say here.
Well, Tarantino has said he's a huge fan of The Grand Silence.
Yeah, and like, you can see that.
No, yeah.
Relevance is, it's set, you know, for those who haven't seen it, I just want to say a couple of things. In visual terms, if you've played Red Dead Redemption 2, it's just before you come down into Valentine, right? It's a bit up in the snow. But I'd also say if you were thinking of watching it, don't read a plot synopsis first. And specifically, I mean Wikipedia's or the synopsis that's on IMDb. Because a bit like when we get to next week's film and we start talking about who is Harmonica, and we find out right near the end of the film in that case, but here we find out about 45 minutes in. If you read a plot synopsis, it's the first paragraph. So you think you're going to see a scene, and then you think you're going to see X years later, and it's not how the film is structured. So it gives too much away and takes away things that you should be finding out for yourself. Everyone's name, it's not that important. Let the film tell you in its own time. It's they've got a hard way of living. It looks like it would have been a hard shoot as well. You know, this was filmed, a lot of this was filmed in Italy, which is rare in itself, because obviously Spain used to stand in. Also, and I don't know, I actually went on Amazon because I had a rip of this. I went on Amazon and had a look. You know, if I went and bought a copy of this, what would I be watching it in? And the language is Italian. So I was watching it in Italian with English subtitles. That's not obviously true of any of the versions of the Dollars trilogy or any of the other films we're going to watch from the comfort of our sort of British English speaking country. But yes, I watched the film in Italian tonight. Now, Klaus Kinski's not Italian. Trantino isn't either. And there's the female lead's American. Yeah, it looks like a hard shoot. It does look like a very tough thing. But random things I noticed was... the two male leads have a similar facial structure. They're coloured differently, but if you glanced at them once each, you could confuse them. And I don't know if that was deliberate. If it was, it's a very, very clever piece of casting. That they're all shades of grey. The idea that, we will give this bit away. He's referred to as Silence, and we think that it's because, or it's theorised at the start, that it's because, you know, he kills people. He gives them ultimate silence. One of the women explained that. But it's quite simply the reveal 45 minutes in, and that this is your last spoiler warning. Anyone who goes away and watch it first. What it is that he has been silenced. One of the major characters killed his parents and cut his neck so he couldn't tell anybody about it when he was a child. So he's a silent assassin, and he's going around protecting outlaws. Now these outlaws are desperate. This is part of the reason, this is the whole reason the film is in snow. They have been snowed in by a blizzard, which is starting to ease towards the end of the film, as you can see sun and all the rest of it. And so they're desperate, they're hungry, and so they're robbing people for money. And bounty hunters are going around and killing them on the say-so of one guy who then uses it to sort of steal all their things, including their houses and everything else. And so you've got the good guy is protecting bad guys who aren't really bad guys. They're just desperate and they are being hunted by the ultimate bad guys. So it's all shades of grey. I think as well, I've kept talking through these revisionist westerns about the end of a way of life. And this is the end of a way of life even more blatantly than in the films we've covered. We're going to cover either side of it. Once Upon a Time in the West, it's very much a theme, but it's here, it's in every frame of the film, that these bounty hunters won't be able to carry on for very long. And rather than it being this slowly, this thing that dawns on you slowly as the film unfolds and you sense the melancholia of the life coming to an end, we're told at the start, outlaws, you need to hang on because there is there's clemency coming. You're going to be pardoned. Okay, this will all end. You will be pardoned. And the sheriff that is sent in actually says to the bad guy, not very long before his ultimate end in the film, he says, law and order is coming. You know, we're going to stop crime effectively, which is a bit over the top. But what he's saying is, we're not going to be paying bounty hunters to do this. And I was saying that last week, before even seeing this film, that these people are making a living out of something that when organized law comes, they won't be able to do anymore. You won't be sending out, sheriffs won't be sending out people saying, bring this person in, and okay if they're dead when you bring them in. That's not how law and order is going to work. So, I don't know if I've got much more to say. In first thoughts for me, I'd never seen it before. I was deeply impressed by it. I loved the score without remembering any of it, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. I think I'll watch it many more times, because the other thing is, it's, what is it, 115 minutes? 105 minutes. It's quite a short film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 45, is it?
And key beats happen at key points. The first act of the film is about half an hour. Then you find out Silence's background at 45 minutes. He gets into a physical relationship with the lead woman on about an hour. The final act starts at about an hour and 10, hour and 15. The film, you could almost, like, where you think certain, if you were told where the plot happens and you plotted where it should happen in the running time, it pretty much all does. So I've not seen a film in this series filmed this paced this well yet.
And yet when you get to the end, where you think it's going to be this big epic like sort of sequence,
and it's
like
not.
and it literally, it pulls the rug from under you, and they're like, see you later, bye.
The thing is, not every bit of story is told within the confines of a film's running time, because before the sheriff, I'm calling him the sheriff, but the guy who was sent there, I've forgotten his name off the top of my head, before he's killed, he says, you kill a lawman, you're going to have problems. Well, eventually, they might ride off, but eventually this way of life is going to catch up with them. And they've not left with very much. They've just basically shot everyone and run off, ridden off. So... yeah, that's the only thing. I need to live with it a few more times to see if I think that's a bit of almost a waste at the end, or whether it's genius. I don't know if that's a genius way to end the film, or whether you finish it and go, well, what was that all about then? And that's not necessarily a criticism. That's just a response that's only had about 2 hours to percolate in my mind. Mm. But I had a great time watching it. And Charlie's right on Klaus Kinski. I mean, wasted playing a hunchback in one of the other films.
I think just generally whatever he's on, like his reputation off screen kind of abounds really for being a sort of fiery personality, difficult to work with, but that sort of thing. But
reputation's awful. But the Henry Pollicutt character, that's my only thing, Luigi Pistilli. I wish we'd seen a bit more of him. I don't know whether that would have unbalanced the film.
Yeah, he was quite underwritten, I thought.
But apart from that, that's all I really want to say as I sort of run into it.
No, yeah, definitely. Thanks to Charlie for the recommendation. It's one of those films that I kind of, sadly, I've not seen before. A lot of these films that we're coming to on our show have kind of been on my list for a long, 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 long time. But I didn't even know this one was available. I know that sounds really stupid and ignorant. A lot of the Western genre fans are going to be like, oh, my God, facepalm moment. So I can only apologise once again. But yeah, I didn't know it was still available. And you're like, oh, it's on YouTube. So it's an excellent version that's on YouTube. I've kind of thought, oh, no, it's going to be really grainy. The sound's going to be off. But actually, it's fantastic. And it's amazing that it hasn't been taken down. So listeners, if you're seeking out a copy of this film for free, check it out on YouTube. Literally just type in The Great Silence and it'll be there. And there's also a couple of good documentaries, making of explainers and of it as well. They're also available from various channels. One is from Little White Lies, I think, about how this influenced Tarantino's films and westerns, for example, as well. And there's another one about, I think it's called like Western in the Snow, something like that. Ooh. There's your alarm, wake up.
There's also a very good Eureka Blu-ray from a new, it was from a new 4K scan recently. Ooh. And that's got a couple of good kind of interviews and documentaries on there, including one about spaghetti westerns in general, and also it's got the a couple of the two alternate endings for this film.
Yeah,
I saw Happy Ending as one of the endings. I would have been disappointed if that's just, you know, ending nicely.
Yeah. Yeah.
A Masters of Cinema. We cover lots of Masters of Cinema.
They go to a massage parlour and...
I read there's like an ambiguous ending and a happier ending, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, it's one of those kind of, obviously, because it is highly politicised. The ending is obviously, you know, it's suitably bleak, where sort of greed and corruption and capitalism kind of wins out, unfortunately, because that's what was going on both in Europe and America at the time as well. And that's kind of what everybody was railing against, sort of in sort of late 60s, early 70s, a lot of political upheaval, student riots, civil unrest, just it's all going to pop, basically. And things that were happening on the screen, you know, reflecting that, a few classic movies at the time. We see a lot of disaster films emerging at this sort of time, especially in the mid to late to mid 70s as well. Obviously Watergate, you've got that stuff going on as well. There's all that kind of a lot of upheaval, a lot of political turmoil and change, sort of railing against the old ways. And as Charlie said, you know, a revisionist Western is definitely the way, because it's traditionally all about sort of like traditional American values against traditional American landscape. But here you've kind of got everything flipped on its head, and by the end of this film, it's all just completely upside down.
It sort of makes sense that it's all, I'm still figuring it out. Perhaps it makes sense that it's all a bit of a mess at the end, because there's no good guys in this, really.
It's all kind of great. I mean, they are pretty much like Silence. And this is his name Loco? Is his name Tigrero? What is his name? Plaskinski's character?
Loco Tigrero? I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah, because there's another kind of making of a documentary that I watched, and said that his name's Tigrero, and I was like, okay, I thought he was called Lake, but never mind.
They're two
ends of the same thing. They are kind of like equal,
and they
opposites.
Look alike. They do. I think they look alike.
They both do the same job. Both sort of like, you know, killers for hire, killers for money, basically.
And she's trying to sell her house to pay Silence.
Yeah,
literally.
You know what I mean? I just want to say one thing on the Masters of Cinema range, because both Charlie and I have covered lots of those for Set the Tape. They're always good as a baseline. Sometimes they're outstanding. There's normally a collector's booklet. This one runs to 36 pages, which is above average.
Ooh, Charlie, did you write it? Did you contribute?
Hang on. There are two essays by the author Howard Hughes. I've seen his work before. They're good. There's a background on the making of The Great Silence and a piece on the westerns of Klaus Kinski. But the thing is, there are three commentaries. One of them is Alex Cox. Three different commentaries on this film, and a 38-minute documentary on a 1968 documentary on Italian westerns. That is, anytime you see something in the Masters of Cinema range, they will restore it as best they can, and they will get. Sometimes it's at the cheaper end. They'll just have a couple of talking heads, but they get people to provide thoughtful content. And they tend to do the final word. I mean, the only company that's anywhere near as good is what's the other one? The one that did RoboCop recently.
Arrow
are masters of cinema for newer films, basically, in my opinion.
Fantastic.
If it goes back before about 1970, masters of cinema are better. So yeah, worth looking out if you like this film, which I certainly did.
Yeah, I bought the Blu-ray for this, especially, and didn't realize it was actually on YouTube, but, you know,
there you go.
I'm glad I actually do have the, a copy of it anyway, because it is a nice copy, and you got all the featurettes, it's got all the commentaries, which I will probably look at now, because it's the first Fury Knight.
Well, one is Howard Hughes and Richard New. Now, I can't always remember exactly who they are, but I recognise the names, and I've definitely heard commentaries by the pair of them. The next one is filmmaker Mike Siegel. I know the name, but I can't remember it. Alex Cox, we all know who he is.
Yeah, we all know Alex Cox.
Although that was recorded live, so I imagine it's a bit like the Back to the Future commentary where they're having a conversation about the film and it isn't actually scene specific. Interview with Austin Fisher, author of Radical Frontiers in the Spaghetti Western Politics, Violence and Popular Italian Cinema, and then another feature by Cox. But 15 minutes are very like his intros to Movie Drum.
Yeah, I just talking about that, there's a little kind of featurette about the film Uncle Bucci by Alex Cox that is very much like his Movie Drum intros. And Movie Drum was where I first saw this film. And it was like the early 90s, I think.
Yeah, it would be. I mean, it would be.
When they did the intro, did they kind of ruin the ending? Or did they just...
Do you mean, did they talk about it?
I can't remember. It was so long ago. But I imagine they didn't. They might have just kind of...
They might have done on the disc, because they're assuming people have bought it seen it.
Yeah, they do on the disc, but intro, they wouldn't have.
I think, yeah, I mean, because I always knew it had a downbeat ending. But I never knew, like, what exactly that was. You know, because downbeat ending, it can be like... Well, it can be anything really. It can be a bit of a, can be a bit of a wash sometimes. It's not usually like, the bad guys win completely wholesale. Like, you know, and it's just grim.
Well, a couple of major characters die at the end of Once Upon a Time in the West, and I don't think of that as a sad ending necessarily.
You can have like
there are shades of grey. Yeah.
Yeah, you can have a bit of a bleak ending where like. In movie terms, yes, it's a victory, but it lose to like bad times are coming kind of thing. Or there's.
I like the fact the character's listed as Gordon / Silence. It's like the Great Gordon. That would have
been. Great Gordon.
That's getting close to the Great Soprendo. You'd be expecting magic tricks or something.
I think that's because I think his father, the character's father, is named Gordon, so that could be a surname.
No, it would actually be the fact he played his father as well. So it's just the fact that he played both, right. But it confused me slightly. I'm thinking, was this character referred to as Gordon as well? No, okay. It says Tigrero's Italian. Tigrero. They probably called him Tigrero on screen, but I was reading the subtitles and it came up as Loco.
But on the... I couldn't kind of see, because I was trying. Obviously, because it's dubbed sort of in Italian.
And I never thought I'd see a character in like a western called Pauline Middleton. That just sounds like she should be from Surrey.
Yeah, that's all these kind of bizarre English names. Like, huh? Okay. Can we talk about Pauline as well? She was amazing because like the actress, obviously, this is like her big screen debut, playing such a multi-layered character in that as well. And obviously, you've got her character. She basically owns her own sexuality. Like, she's not going to be pushed around by any of the men who try to take advantage of her. You know, she uses like her own sexuality during the love scene with Silence, which is filmed in such a really kind of tender, romantic way. Obviously, cause it's a romantic scene, but you know, it doesn't really care whether she loves him or not. It's obviously just trying to fill a gap.
Which gap are we putting money on in Philly?
But you know, obviously her husband's been killed brutally, so she's just trying.
And he wants to park in his space.
Yeah, let's park in that gap. In that gap. I think there's a joke there somewhere, I'm sure. But also, you kind of got that kind of it's quite rare at that time to see kind of an interracial relationship. I know that sounds really stupid. I don't know how else to say it. So I do apologise for any offence caused. But to see that kind of relationship on screen, especially at that time, it wasn't very common. Started to become more accepted as well. Certainly not even on like TV. I mean, like Star Trek, for example, was hugely progressive for doing something like that. And nowadays, it's everywhere. You know, it's perfectly normal. But like at this time of, you know, sort of 60s and sort of 70s, it wasn't all that common really. So it's quite sort of shocking and very progressive for that as well. And the fact that she's got a very boring sounding name which is quite funny. But I think to play that kind of character for, you know, for an actress in a debut role is just incredible. I think for me, she's my favourite character in the film. You know, she totally owns her sexuality, owns the position that she's in, just wants to get vengeance for, you know, for her husband who's been brutally murdered.
Which position do you reckon she was in?
Sorry. Which kind of, well, I don't know, that's for you to decide.
Okay.
Missionary.
Funny enough, the...
You know what I mean, though. She's, you know, lost her husband.
I know. Oh, absolutely.
And, yeah.
The episode of Star Trek, Plato's Stepchildren, which had the interracial kiss between Uhura and Kirk, was actually broadcast in November of 1968, so the same year.
Oh, yes, around the sort of I did think it was around that sort of time. Thank you. I knew you'd come in with that fun fact. Just because I happened to see an exhibition recently which had a replica of Uhura's costume, and obviously it highlighted the fact that, you know, that was the first time it had been shown, certainly on American television.
This wasn't screened in the United States, though.
No, exactly. It's very much a European production. I think, wasn't it? I want to say, I don't think it was Z-Cars, but it was one of those really early, like, I can't remember the name of it, it was about a hospital, I think. It's certainly over here in England. Was it sort of late 50s, early 60s? We had sort of kind of like a sort of interracial kiss as well. But again, it was very, very early days. I want to say maybe, sort of 50s, 60s. It might have been 60s, perhaps. I'm not very good about British television history. Pre-Doctor Who. But, you know, it's kind of, you know, really early times and quite shocking. But, yeah, there's so many things, you know. She's not your kind of traditional female character that's found in the Westerns. You know, she's kind of not very much not the...
You'll see one next week, plenty of agency as well.
Compared to the lady, I can't remember her character name, kind of, you know, runs the inn. She's like, well, she wants to... The corrupt sort of guy, kind of like, well, you know... Busy gentlemen like you should be served by women like me.
Regina.
Carl Skinsky's character makes a sort of crude joke about how she serves basically the whole of the army. So you've got immediate contrast there as well between these two female characters.
But then she says that the other guy, that Pistilli's character, should hang.
But exactly, that's it. Yeah.
So there's she's still kind of strong. And
she still kind of gives as good as she gets. That's it, you know, a lot of the women in this film, they're not going to, obviously, the ones who do die is very sad. And there's, you know, the old lady right at the start as well, who's like, you know, you need to avenge the death, you know, please kill him, I'll give you however much you want. But yeah, the sort of women, female characters found in this film aren't your typical, you know, that you would see in this genre, but by no means. It just kind of blows, you know, all those kind of tropes and stereotypes out of the water, really, which again makes it... but yeah, definitely, I was got blown away by this film. As soon as it finished, I was like, right, were I not doing this podcast, I quickly rewind it and watch it again. But yeah, I think what I'll do is I'll check out price points and everything. But I will.
Do you know what I find incredible?
I'm trying to pick up trying to pick up the home release of this.
I might do, and I don't buy discs anymore, so we'll see.
I'm gonna fall off my chair and surprise.
But what I found incredible was you sometimes forget. This is the thing with subtitles. I have no issue with people who'd rather listen to dubbing. It's up to them. Enjoy a film however you want to. But sometimes I get so into a film, I forget it's, like, subtitles. Like, literally, I was watching it downstairs on my TV today, and I needed the loo. So I went into the toilet, and I left the film running because I thought...
You take it with you?
No, because I thought, I'll just leave it running because I'll I'll listen to it. And I went in the loo, and I suddenly thought, this is in Italian. Right? And I'd been watching it for an hour. Now, I knew it was in Italian, but, like, on some level, I'd almost, stopped thinking about it, and I just went to the toilet, like I might with any film, particularly if I've seen it before, and I'll go, I can still hear it from here. So, yeah, the film had me. It really did.
Yeah, really good, definitely. But yeah, thank you for recommending it.
The two versions, though, because I did flip between, because I had the Blu-ray, so I
you've
have,
got
like,
different versions, yeah? I'm sorry, I got what was on YouTube.
Yeah, so I got the... So I did watch the Italian... speaking version with the English subtitles, but it had like an English dubbing. But I flipped through it; it still had the subtitles, and like the English dubbing and subtitles were different.
So they don't match. No, I don't.
Had like Dizzy, but also like had a completely different set of dialogue.
I noticed it in a couple of places because obviously there is something in common. I can't speak Romanian and I can't speak French, but I understand a little bit of both. And I heard, and some of it's obviously derived from Latin, which I did a bit of, and there was certainly a bit where the sheriff said something, and the subtitles came up with something of the same spirit, but it wasn't a literal translation.
Well, in the dub version, the sheriff's name is Burnett, and in the Italian version, his name is Corbett.
Right. Yeah, that's why. Yeah, because the Italian version is the one that's on YouTube, yeah. And the sub didn't match the dub, and I was like, hmm. Hence my confusion over what Karskinski's character name was.
If you watch a lot of dubbed foreign films, you'll notice that because they're being dubbed for a certain locality, that they will be subtly, sometimes not. Like you take the original Godzilla film and some of those. The dialogue and was changed specifically for the American audiences.
So yeah, there'll be a sort of regionality there, won't they?
Most of these films are going to be dubbed for America.
But what most people don't do though is read subtitles for their own language, because we don't need them. But of course, I live with someone.
I stay subs on all the time.
But my wife it's not her first language. I mean, she's fluent, but it's not her first language, and she often says to me, it's a default now. The subtitles are on because she said it helps me learn. I hear something, I go, what's that they're saying? Okay. And you will see all the time they're shortening it for the subtitles. Somebody will say a sentence of 15 words and the subtitles might only be 6.
But they'll try and get the gist of it, won't they?
They'll try and get the gist of it, yeah.
Yeah, I think localization, I think that's really important, especially in games as well, where they're translated for European audience, English audience, American audience, for example. I've got a version of Professor Layton game, for example, for America, has quite slight differences to the one that was localized for over here, for the UK. I just think that's really interesting, actually, as well. But I mean, it does help me to learn. If I'm learning German or something like that, I want to watch it with the subtitles on, trying to help you listen to the language. Sorry, Charlie, carry on.
Shrek and those kind of the Shrek films.
Yeah.
Because they always had the little parts where of the bartender or something like that, and they put in there an American talk show host or something like that.
Yeah, was it David Letterman, or somebody like that? And then over here, it's Jonathan Ross.
Yeah, the one I can think of, yeah. It was Shrek 2, I think, and it was Larry King over there.
Larry King, that was Jonathan, not Letterman,
Jonathan Ross here.
Over here as Rossi. So, yeah, that's a great example, definitely. Mm. Yeah, so, localization, it does happen. But no, that was really interesting, actually. And obviously, obviously at the end of The Greatest Silence, there's that the kind of postscript, isn't there? And obviously, that's going to be either in French, German, Italian, wherever you are in the world.
Again, the version I've got, because it's not a disc, I'm going to assume it's legal. It certainly had the film. I forget what it is now. The distribution company, I think.
The Film Movement one.
Film Movement, yeah.
Because I couldn't find my disc, so I watched it.
Yeah, I think. I just need to quickly Google something, but I think they also
the obviously the original Italian is hard coded into the picture, and then it comes up with British subtitles over the top of that sort of postscript.
Yeah.
I will be looking.
I've in touch with Film Movement because they released the
that's right.
Ernst Marischka CC films.
Well, when you think about it,
where do I know that name?
I've always liked westerns, but I've probably seen relatively few, but I've covered quite a lot in the last 18 months or so, and there's been a few of them from Masters of Cinema, and this would be right near the top, not necessarily at the absolute top, but it's better than most of the fare that comes out is all right. It's okay. But very few of them ever stand out as, oh, I love that one. You know, I did Run Man Run a few weeks ago. I did Sabata a few months before that. I've just done the Dollars trilogy. And there's been a few others as well here and there, some older, more traditional ones like Man Without a Star and stuff like that. And very few of them I ever come away going, oh, I need to see this again. And this is one of them. And I cannot remember the last time I forgot I was watching a film with subtitles. Literally forgot. I had it a little bit with Inglourious Bastards, because I remember reading that 70% of that film is not in the English language, and I couldn't believe it. I thought it was more like 20%. Yeah. About 20% of it was non-English, but no. Shall we discuss this film sequentially, folks?
Yes, go on.
Interesting when Charlie mentioned how rare snow films were in this genre. The reason I say that is this is where you're never quite sure of your own knowledge, because me having not seen them doesn't mean they don't exist, of course. All I could think of was The Hateful Eight, which is obviously, you know, his spin on films he loved and stuff like that. It's very rare you don't see it in that arid
environment, because they're always sort of shot, if they're shot in America, they're shot in Arizona, you know, in Nevada or somewhere like that.
Or Mexico or somewhere.
Yeah, and so they're normally somewhere in the very south, or they're shot in Spain. And, I mean, the TV show Deadwood, which I've mentioned a few times, is like North Dakota or something. So that's very sort of muddy. They walk down the main street and they're just getting absolutely caked in mud. But normally, yeah, it's normally this arid environment. And I did get Tarantino things where you sort of see somebody in the distance heading slowly towards. And again, that's very much a Western's trope. But
yeah, that's a bit of a trope.
Bizarrely, because the desert almost, I mean, desert is about rainfall. I mean, the largest desert in the world is like Antarctica or something. But we think of deserts by sort of being big. You know, it's 3 weeks in every direction and that sort of thing. And
but also it's a human like moving through like a harsh environment as well, like it's kind of a great snowy environment. It's just, you know, it's still quite harsh, quite.
Do you know what I think it is? I think it's a lack of landmarks. It's because it is just an absolute sea of snow. They could be anywhere. You can't see really anything.
No, but from mountains, and so that's pretty much it.
It almost feels more isolated, even though by definition, it's not.
No, that's it. I mean, you always have, and obviously it's a completely different genre, but also you have sort of having like sort of murder mysteries or those kind of like kind of genres, you know, kind of disparate strangers hold up during a snowstorm or something like that, don't you? It's very much like, you know, it's that kind of trope as well, isn't it? I guess like as I say, we did have in Hateful Eight for sure. So,
Charlie, I wouldn't normally sort of do the behind the scenes stuff, but I will just say this: Charlie's just sent me a link or sent us a link. If you typed in spaghetti. spaghetti-western.net, you basically get the Spaghetti Western database. And .net. I will look at this in my own time, but it's not just like IMDb where you get all the details on films. It's got stuff about Blu-ray releases as well.
Yeah, it's spaghetti-western.net. Check it out.
Yeah, because I follow them on Twitter as well, where it's at SW database.
SWDB.com.
They talk about new releases all the time, because another thing about these films is, I mean, The Great Silence, that was its first UK premiere on TV in the 90s. Because of the BBFC as well, and the crackdown on violence in films and things like that, and also because of sometimes, I mean, certainly this film's lack of commerciality with its ending. these films, we don't see them here. So,
no, we don't.
I'd never heard of it, Charlie, and I'm secure enough in myself to say that publicly. Not heard of it.
Yeah, well, that's what Beck was saying earlier, and she was excoriating herself for not having heard of it. It's like, it's not a well-known film.
Corbucci is somewhat well-known, but he had quite a long filmography. Yeah.
Oh yeah,
most of us have heard of Django. That's it.
Django.
I think that's probably why it's so underrated, and it's kind of one of these films. Obviously, well, I can, you know, having seen the Dollars trilogy, I can see why it is iconic. It is, they're hugely influential, and you know their importance on certainly, you know, as I've kind of said before, like just in terms of the genre and in cinema, it does cast a long shadow, and they're really landmark films as well. But then so is this. Kind of got to look. You can't, you know, obviously Tarantino's testament to that for sure. But it deserves, you know, having seen it, but just being blown away by it.
I could spend the
frankly.
Rest of my life diving into this stuff.
I probably will watch it again tonight.
I really could. I don't love everything, but it's.
No, it's good. I think the score is pretty good as well. But I mean, Kids is just fantastic. He's just American. He's just amazing.
Sorry, go on, Charlie. What?
It's like how we were horror. I mean, me being a big horror fan, I actually wrote an article about this in a couple of. I think it was the Film Stories magazine.
Ooh.
It was nice. a couple of issues back about getting dodgy bootleg copies of Texas Chainsaw Massacre and The Exorcist because they were banned over here.
Video nasties, weren't they, pretty much?
So if you want to see these films, and this applies to the Westerns as well, is you've got to find... you've got to find these dodgy VHSs that they're either bootlegged or you know, VHS was never great when it was official anyway.
No.
And a lot of these times, I mean, these films were not released. Some films were not released outside of Italy with English subtitles. It's like trying to get some French films, trying to get them even now on Blu-ray and DVD. They don't put English subtitles on them. And I reviewed a film the other day. for another new label called Radiance Films, which are really good. And it was a French kind of buddy road movie called Fill 'Em Up With Super, and sort of set from the 70s. And it was the first time that the Blu-ray they've released is the first time it ever been made available worldwide with an English subtitle.
Oh, wow. That's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah. So it's just getting hold of these films.
Yeah,
just
like, are these difficult?
Yeah, that's why Movie Germ was so good, because they were kind of bring these films over.
Yeah, kind of bring these sort of unknown movies over and try to get them to... I think we've had this discussion before. They need to bring back Movie Germ, don't they, really?
Yeah, they did.
Just bring it back. I just think get Alex Cox going. Bring him out of Deep Freeze. Revive that movie, The Doing Strand.
Yeah, but like you were saying about the opening scene with the snow, and it's so isolating, and you say you've got five or so guys waiting for a silence.
But I should have felt the same way at the start of The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly or something, but I didn't, not to the same degree. It's something about the snow.
Yeah, and you trotting through the snow, and you've got five guys or so waiting for him.
I was worried about his poor horse as well. I thought, my God, he's going to freeze to death.
When we say five guys, not the burger company.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like, where are these guys going to come from, and is he going to be all right?
It also just looks it just looks great as well.
Yeah, it looks amazing.
It is kind of what amazes me, how not many other westerns have utilized, like, set it in the snow landscape. You know,
you feel like they missed the trick.
Yeah, because it just looks great. You know what I mean? It's possible. You know,
at least they've got a reason to do it here.
This is it.
Yeah.
If you tried to do this in a hot environment, the only thing they might be missing is water or something. It has to be this, really.
No, this is kind of what I was getting at, because on our chat, I can tell you about mise-en-scène, I can tell you about plot, character, you know, that kind of stuff. But when it comes to technicalities, I'm not that great. So I kind of asked about like the properties of Technicolor or Eastman color, which is the process that this film was made through. I thought, is it particular? Look, obviously Technicolor films are very, very bright and very vibrant, and all the colors kind of very rich and just leap off the screen and into your eyeballs. But with Eastman color, obviously it was very, very cheap. It was a lot easier to use. It's more accessible. And eventually, why it sort of went out, really. And I kind of wondered, does it kind of give, obviously everything's a little bit more kind of bit more muted, a bit it's quite gritty, it's quite grainy, I guess, although the transfer was really, really good. Just in terms of looking like some of the Powell and Pressburger films, for example, like Black Narcissus, which is Technicolor, just looks so vibrant. And then when you get to kind of like the later films, they kind of, it's still very colourful, but perhaps look a bit more lurid and look a bit more kind of a bit seedy, perhaps. But not that this film looks easy at all, but I kind of wondered, did using Eastman colour have an effect on like the way this film looks as well? I mean, obviously it was chosen perhaps for its cheapness, perhaps. But I don't mean cheapness in really tacky way that it's horrible, you know, sort of thing, but just in terms of, and its ease of use and accessibility. But perhaps did it help to give this film its really iconic look, that it is kind of a bit more bleak, you know, and unforgiving, perhaps.
I don't know if it's iconic, but it's certainly appropriate.
Yeah. I think it looks iconic. Everything to me is iconic, really, quite frankly. You're an icon and you're a legend. That's as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I don't really think it's famous enough to be
that's,
iconic.
That's what I mean by
no.
that.
No.
But when you say enough, iconic, you tend to be praising, and we're not disagreeing with that, though.
No. But I wonder if using that process and that sort of film stock really did help to give this film its kind of look, really, compared to other Westerns. You know, in the same way, or is it just that it's
difficult to tell, because you have to know how everything else was shot, and the information you get on different films just varies. I mean, even if you go to it's edited individually by people, but you go to a Wikipedia and the information on different films, not only in depth but in format, doesn't match up. So let me give you an example of this.
What I think about Wikipedia is, I mean, it's a useful resource, but it's written by people.
Yeah, well, let me read you what it says under The Great Silence box office, all right, and tell me if this makes fucking sense to you whatsoever. Box office, £309 million, Italy, right? in brackets. Does that mean in Italy? Does that mean an Italian source? Either way, it would be bollocks, because nothing was taking £309 million in that year. It wasn't doing it in the early 80s in pounds, but there you go. 570,486 admissions, brackets, France.
And yes, is that just in France? US, or, yeah, please explain.
$53,000 US re-release. Well, what do you mean by re-release? It had never been released there. So you've got paid admissions, dollars and pounds, and probably different amounts of inflation. One's probably adjusted for inflation, and they're all completely unreliable sources. So it's meaningless. We don't know how well this film did.
Yeah, I think it was re-released in the OOs or something.
Yeah.
It could have even been.
It still
Tarantino
wouldn't have done over $309 million. There's no Western that's done.
Well, no. That's ridiculous. But an interesting thing about what Becca was saying is on the IMDb, under the technical specifications bit, they tell you who processed the film and what it was shot on.
Yeah.
It's like it's like talking about Once Upon a Time in America, which is full Technicolor.
Yeah, it would
be.
And it, the difference in, yeah, it does make a difference with the kind of the grittiness of some of these films.
But I was imagining, like, if it was shot in Technicolor, for example, obviously the reds would be a lot more like it would be. I mean, it's quite a bloody film anyway, but it would be even more so, especially against the contrast of the snow. But I was kind of thinking, obviously, does shooting with a different process or a different film stock.
The only example kind of I've ever seen of that where you can see a film shot.
I know that's
really
stupid, and I'm sorry.
No, there's only one film I can think of. Charlie may be able to think of some more. Certainly back in the silent era, there may have been. But the only film I can think of that was genuinely shot in two different formats completely was Oklahoma. They'd shot it on one format in the morning and another in the afternoon. And so look up Oklahoma. It was shot two completely different ways.
Should we include that in all of the Westerns?
No.
Don't call yourself stupid for not knowing something. Mm. Especially in these kind of areas where
It would be more stupid to sort of pretend that you did know.
That's the thing. I've been doing the show for years, coming on and pontificating about films, and I've got to sit here and say a fairly well-known film by Sergio Cabusi never heard of. So, you know, you've got to have the balls to just own it and go, I don't know, don't worry about
it. I was kind of, you mentioned it and I was like, I've not seen that. I was just one of those things where, like, this genre, I mean, obviously, especially because, you know, my useless degree, been in American studies, but literally.
Yeah, but it wasn't a Westerns, was it?
Well, we've barely even touched on it, to be honest, which is really interesting. And obviously now they don't run the course at all, which is a great shame.
It's like when you introduced me as a film music expert.
We are.
But I kind of always kind of balk at saying that because there's loads of stuff that I don't know as well. And I'm happy to not know because I love learning about it.
Mm. What should I call you instead?
Don't call me that. I'm just saying.
I mean, that expert is like, is such a
nebulous
such
term.
It's
a catch-all term, really, isn't it?
Because I mean, like, you know, I mean, at what point would you honestly, like, would anyone say I'm an expert? It just sounds so fucking pretentious, doesn't it? When you
have you spent 100,000 hours or whatever to call yourself a master?
Well, that's it. To go back to Gary Lineker for a second, I saw someone talking about how Match of the Day was so much better because there were no.
It was an MP as well.
It was 20 minutes long.
It was an MP, and it was an MP with the union flag in his fucking profile.
Yeah, okay. and he said because there were no so-called experts talking over it. It's like, do you know Gary Lineker played for fucking Barcelona?
he might know something about it.
He did kick a ball around, and now he's, you know, quite rightly licensed, you know, he's able, legitimately to talk about kicking a ball around.
Yeah, so these people have played consistently at the highest level of football, and they've gone to World Cups and all this, and it's just like, shut the fuck up.
He's uniquely placed to do
You're
it.
Embarrassing yourself. Exactly. Back to the film.
Anyway, I think this is going to be like one of the most interesting episodes that we've done to date.
Oh, I'm looking at them just on the just
sponsored by Walkers.
No, the sponsored funny thing, by... the funny thing, somebody from Set the Tape, Neil, he's put up, not Neil, what's he called? Anyway, he's put up the ticker from BBC News at the moment, and it's just the confluence of different information they put on the screen makes it sound so much worse than it is. BBC News breaking. BBC Gary Lineker crisis. BBC's crisis. Football coverage disrupted across new TV and radio, and then the next line says New York City 0643, London 0643, 54. It's got times around the world so that like you know exactly what the time was in Seoul when you found out the BBC was having a Gary Lineker crisis.
Crisis is a bit far-fetched. I don't really think it's a crisis.
No, it's not. It's embarrassing. That's all it is.
We're in a cost of living crisis.
That's a crisis.
Coronavirus is a crisis. We're not in a bloody...
That's a crisis. So we meet the Silence character very early on, and there's two things to note. We talk about the end of the West. This film is set in 1898, sorry. So right near the end, and again, video game fans, Red Dead Redemption 2 was the following year, and that was very much the end of the West. Mm. And obviously the first one was set even later, 1911, I think. The other thing that gives it away, and I've got no interest in guns, very few Brits do, but I saw the weapon he pulled and I thought that looks a little modern, so I looked it up, and it's a Mauser C96. Basically it's a semi-automatic, which didn't come in until about 1896, so the modern world is starting to impinge here.
He's kind of got technology as a kind of as an advantage for him, really, doesn't it? It kind of gives him a bit of a leg up.
But the film only tells us, it never loses us. You never sit there going, I wonder what this is about, particularly. It's telling you what you need to know, but not everything straight away. He is about to be shot at, and he's basically... it's quite seeding it quite nicely. He waits for people to pull guns on him first, so that anything he does is self-defense. He doesn't waste bullets. And if he can get away without killing people, he will. He shoots off their thumbs because they then can't shoot back. And he's protecting a group of outlaws, really. But for outlaws, just read, and I don't mean to sound all socialist here, but they're just desperate people. That's not to say crime's all right, but they're just starving people in a blizzard. And he's protecting them.
I think the concept is that they're basically like people getting screwed over.
Yes.
Yeah, they've had their homes taken away and stuff.
So, like, they're kind of being forced into banditry.
Yeah, and also we find out
got a corrupt banker.
We find out from Pauline that they're almost forced into crime economically, so that he can take their assets from them. But yes, technically they are outlaws. And Silence has no opinion, and the fact that he's silent actually helps because he's got no opinion to voice.
Does he? He might have an opinion, but we just don't know.
Yeah. So
I kind of think he's actually... I mean, Clint Eastwood is legendary as Blondie, Mamma No Name, whatever you want to call him.
That's the right use of legendary.
he's legendary anyway, definitely.
He's had an all right career, isn't he?
Yeah.
He's done all right. He's Dirty Harry. He's Mamma No Name. Don't mess with him, just basically.
Pick a random film he did in the 80s that was vaguely erotic.
Although he was also in that film with an orangutan. So,
which was brilliant.
It
was two different. It was two different orangutans.
That was a fun film. I remember watching that in the 90s.
I know Any Which Way You Can better than Every Which Way But Loose, but there you go.
I think I've seen Loose pretty much. That's the only one I've seen, so I can't really criticise.
That's where Sandra Locke appears to sing the same song about four dozen times.
What was
times.
My original point?
I can still hear that song in my head. She sings.
We're going to have to do those films, I'm sure. They're orangutan movies. But anyway, no, I would say...
Ape films.
Jonathan Yeo, whose name I can't pronounce, was perhaps a lot cooler in this role. Purely because, you know, he doesn't say anything. He's so inscrutable. You can't guess what he's thinking. You know, he doesn't show it on his face. Both him and Loco are kind of very much... I mean, Loco's he's very charismatic. He's quite charming, but he's also quite sadistic. And both are, you know, quite nasty, both like they kind of got a really good poker face. You can't really see what's going on sort of behind those eyes. I would say that Silence is probably like it was a very cool character, very cool customer, and I think for that he's slightly just centimeters above Clint Eastwood in that kind of role.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that both of the leads. that was pointed out before, aren't Italian. Kinski was German, and Trintignant was French. So you've got kind of the coolness of the French New Wave and those kind of films.
Yes.
That are kind of seeping into it. And he's quite a beautiful man as well.
Both very attractive to look at.
Yeah.
Both like quite easy on the eye.
I did wonder as well, just going back to Dave talking about the gun, if George Lucas had seen, I mean, undoubtedly, I think George Lucas probably did see this at some point, because Han Solo's gun is a Mauser, or is based on a Mauser.
Oh, fun fact.
I can see it in my head now. If you hadn't mentioned it, I'd never have thought of it, but you're absolutely right.
It is like a well-known gun, though, as well, so it...
Oh, yeah, but in a Western, it's kind
yeah.
of...
That's true. In the context,
it's quite unusual, isn't it, to see that kind of gun? A revolver or just a more, you know.
Had I done no prep for this film whatsoever and just watched it, it would have sent me straight to like a Wikipedia. When is this film set?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's just me overthinking as well, but the wooden holster he has is very much like a coffin, and kind of brings me back to Django. Who drags around the machine gun in the coffin.
I nearly put a GIF up tonight just to sort of promote we were recording this, and there is a GIF where it's just him interacting with that holster. All you can see is a hand, and I nearly used that because I thought it looked really cool.
Yeah.
And of course, Django, he has both his hands get crushed, don't they?
Yeah.
I believe it's crushed at the end.
I can't remember. I'm still not convinced I've seen it.
Which kind of happens in...
I'm still not sure if I've seen it. I feel like I must have, particularly when Tarantino started messing around with the name. I might have gone and had a look at it, but I don't remember anything about it. Though the coffin thing made me think. It's like, that's familiar.
You might have seen clips. It's like, you know when like a film gets talked about so much you feel like you know it?
Yeah, possibly.
It's the kind of thing that I wouldn't be surprised if it got re-released at a time.
It's included with Prime, so I can look that up. It's on Amazon Prime, folks. Django. This is the Sergio Corbucci Django. We're not being lazy and meaning Django.
Oh, the original. Nice.
Yeah,
okay.
It's a really good film as well.
Check those out.
It's only an hour and a half as well. I'm looking at that tomorrow. Yeah. I'm having a look at that tomorrow, probably while I'm editing this.
Well, I think Leone is maybe a bit of an outlier when it comes to how length and how epic.
We're very, I don't know which way to deal with this again, because the synopsis doesn't quite fit the order things happens in. But Klaus Kinski's character and various are going around hunting people. But he's putting on an air of just, you know, give yourself up. And this is going to have happened with Silence, his parents as well. You know, the fake sheriff and the just give yourself up. We're not going to hurt you. And yes, we will. So a mother, an elderly woman, encourages her son home just to talk to law enforcement. And of course, they're not really law enforcement. They kill him. And we get very similar with he's basically going around doing these bounties. Now, I don't know if we see the James character, Pauline's husband, die before we see Silence do his first hunt down the killer.
I think we do. I think...
Because two of them turn up. They kill this guy. The mother wants revenge. She goes to Silence and asks for revenge. Mm-hmm. And he goes and hunts down the one who isn't Klaus Kinski while he's playing cards. In a saloon and being rather arrogant about it all and boastful, and he basically gets the guy to draw and then kills him. And at the same time, or just before or just after, I forget the running order, Pauline, this married woman, her husband is hiding on the property. He came home to be with his wife from the outlaws, and he basically grabs hold of her, Klaus Kinski, and forces the other guy out. And says, you know, you'll be in prison and everything else. But as soon as he sees him, he kills him. And he says, put him under the snow to preserve him. But I don't want you to bury him. I need to give this body across to law enforcement. Is that about right?
Yeah. It's because there's the one guy who goes to his mum.
Yeah, that's the guy I'm on about first. Yeah.
Yeah, and then Middleton, so that kind of conflicts thing a bit. So yeah, but that is pretty much right. And then she writes to him. to say that she wants him to come and
she goes, that's what I'm saying, that's where he goes to sort of kill the other guy, but the governor wants order maintained because they we're already told there's an amnesty coming. Where that's coming from, I don't know, because I don't know if this is now in the Union or Utah's in the Union or what. I've no idea. By 1898, Utah in the Union. I'll have a look, actually. But the governor sends, basically... Now, all the prop descriptions describe this guy as bumbling, the guy they send. I don't consider him bumbling at all. Not particularly.
No, he's kind of almost the one that represents the old Westerns.
It was in the Union. Sorry, it came into... Utah was admitted to the Union January 1896. So we're talking about a federal pardon here. I think
he's come to bring law to this town, kind of self-righteously.
Yeah.
Whereas the governor is just trying to get a patsy, really.
Yeah.
So it is very much that he represents the old West.
But he sends him. He said, "I want order." He doesn't want to continue having all these bounties and everything else. So he sends him there. His horse is immediately stolen by the outlaws. For food. So basically he arrives and his horse is stolen, eaten, and he's left walking in the snow. And I don't know if the whole state is I don't know how much of the state the blizzard is affecting. I don't know if it comes
it's fucking very Hateful Eight at the moment though, isn't it? It's
very much. Yeah, it is. He's stolen this from Quentin Tarantino, the arsehole. So
he travelled forward in time, saw Hateful.
I thought, I know what I'm doing with this.
Yeah.
So this is quite decent plotting in that he now meets Silence and Luco, doesn't he?
Yeah. There's the stagecoach that comes past.
Well, they actually save his life, really, because he's walking in the snow and he doesn't look like he's going to die immediately, but he's not properly dressed for it, doesn't have a horse, etc. He's not going to last forever out there.
But is it here that he hides his gun?
I didn't see him hide his gun, but I saw him find it at the end.
Yeah, there's a scene where he did kind of hide it.
He hides a gun. That's relevant to the end of the film. This film is so tightly plotted, it's superb that way. Now, Pauline has written to Silence as well. She wants some help. He's a bit of a local legend that he goes around. And they've obviously heard the name. She says that he's Silence because he brings the silence of death and all the rest of it, which is not why he's called that. It is his vocal cords, and his neck is always covered, so we don't see it till later on. And because it's cold, it doesn't stand out as odd that his neck is covered.
I think that's quite a good reveal, isn't it? I think it's one of those the suspense surrounding like Silence. Is it to do with because he leaves Silence in his wake, or why is he called Silence? And then when it is finally revealed, especially when they flash back to how his parents are murdered and everything, I think that's a really it's one of the most striking reveals that I've seen in a long time.
I really liked the scene between him and Loco in the stagecoach as well, because again, it kind of, you've got supposed hero and villain opposite each other.
Really tense.
One of them is talking constantly, the other one saying no words at all.
No, that's it.
And it's just the kind of the tension between them is really interesting.
Yeah, you kind of got that kind of. They're sort of really opposed, but they're also very similar.
They're not really on each other's radar at this point either. They're not feeling any fear from each other, and like I say, it's the ambiguity. Silence isn't out there just trying to like kill anyone who's bad. He's got no problem with this guy at the moment. But yes, he hears from Pauline, and Pauline is going to try and sell her house cheap at about a fifth of the price she could get for it to Pollicut. But he basically wants sexual favors, and so that doesn't work out. That's how she ended up putting a bounty on her husband in the first place. He wanted her. And are we getting straight to the beating already, where Silence is beaten up?
Yeah, because
he tries to draw
a match, and then
he throws a match into his drink. He lights his cigar.
Yeah.
He's basically trying to get them to draw. Now Loco's power here is that he knows that. Silence will only let them draw, and it actually makes sense they're in the Union now. They're subject to some properly codified laws now.
Yeah.
But self-defense is fine in all circumstances. It just doesn't even get questioned. We'll see that later in the film with the bar owner.
Yeah.
Once you draw and you're seen to draw and there's witnesses, you can be killed.
and he's trying to get the person to draw first so he can shoot. And of course, Loco knows this. You know, it's almost like put Batman in a position where he's got a kill and you'll win. You know,
it's kind of interesting as again, where it's kind of a bit of a stupid thing that silence does. But in a different film, it wouldn't have had the effect that it does in this film.
In what way?
You see films where people make stupid decisions all the time and they don't, it doesn't affect their journey.
Right.
Whereas the fact that he does that and try to draw him out and he won't.
Yeah.
Rise to it.
He's trying to be too honourable. Where really?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Really, what he needs to do is like be less honourable and just be like, shoot the guy in the back.
And again, it's kind of like the chivalry of the old west.
But it's also it's a confused moral environment now as well, because he's trying to stick with the law in order to do the right thing. So it's all rather confused. So yeah, it ends up with he tries to provoke Loco. Basically, it ends up in a beating. Silence gets quite badly beaten. Loco does try to shoot him at some point, but he's stopped by Burnett. We're going to go with the guy. Puts him in prison. And of course, the corrupt character Policut, sort of, he's constantly trying to sort of talk for things that will help him and Loco, so we say, no, you can't just have him here in prison. They'll try and break him out, and they'll do this and they'll do that. He said, well, fine, I'll take him to another prison somewhere else, and it's actually in Nevada, so he's going to take him to another state. And Burnett wisely says to the townspeople, he said, look, because they're all now worried that the outlaws will come into town because law enforcement isn't there, and it will become a free-for-all of violence in the town. And he says, provide food, put food on the outskirts of the town, and they'll stay away. You're feeding the outlaws, that's all they want. So he sets off with that, and meanwhile Pauline and Silence they have sex, but it's actually quite a tender scene, and it's quite long for a western love scene as well.
He tends to his wounds,
cause, she's tended to his wound because he has been caught.
Silence has shot all the rest of his gang.
Yeah.
Because they did draw on him, and
which is another thing. They're the bad guys, but their townspeople are now worried because there's nothing to stop the outlaws, who are good guys but desperate. But Silence has got a wound in his shoulder, sort of just below the collarbone, and so they have sex. So they're now effectively a couple. And Burnett and Loco decides he needs a shit. He basically says he needs to take a dump, and it's where he's hidden his gun early in the film, which is just brilliant because I didn't spot that. But I knew as soon as I saw it. It didn't surprise me when Charlie said, "Is this where he hides his gun?" Because I thought, we must have seen this. This film is too well plotted. We must have seen this gun buried.
It's interesting because he shoots the ice to make Corbett or Burnett die. And it's interesting, I think I mentioned this last time as well, where there's almost like a little kind of troop of actors that keep appearing in these films. I mean, obviously Kinski was in for a few dollars more, and you've got Pistilli, who was in the last films. He was Tuco's brother in this one, and then he was one of the villains in A Few Dollars More. You got Mario Brego, which is the big henchman of Policut, who was Angel Eye's assistant when he beat up Tuco. You got Frank Wolf, who played Burnett, who was actually an American actor. We'll see him again next week briefly.
He pops up next week, doesn't he? He's in a few Roger Corman films as well.
The Sheriff, yeah. Frank Burnett.
I think he might have been in a few ITC shows over here in the 60s.
Yeah, he was in The Saint.
Frank, in the Saint, that was it.
Yeah, Frank Wolf.
Yeah, I used a couple of those. Yeah, they've been showing those on TV recently.
Yeah, he plays McBain in Once Upon a Time in the West. The character that Claudia Cardinale is betrothed to.
Yeah, he's not in much of that film.
No, but he's also in a lot of the Italian giallos and horrors and westerns. And again, another thing that I love about these films is
only lived to the age of 43.
The titles. I mean, you've got one of the unofficial Django films, which is called Django Prepare a Coffin, and he's in one called God Forgives, I Don't.
That's a great name, isn't it? Like a lot of the Django
films. That's a great name. And prepare a coffee. It's so specific as well. Django, cup of tea.
God forgives. I don't. Dot. And like a lot of the Django films also have like alternative titles as well, depending on their translation or depending on where they were released as well.
Yeah,
no, I think that's a really cool point. You get a lot of. It was going to be one of my fun facts actually, Charlie. So I'm glad you mentioned it. Definitely.
Oh, sorry.
No, not at all. No, don't apologise. To be honest, I'm just going to hold my hand up and say I've underprepared. I don't have very many fun facts, as I know that we were going to give out quite a lot of them as we went along. But yeah, I was going to also say that I noticed quite a few, you know, returning cast members that we've seen previously. I mean, was that a particular, not trope, but was that something that like Corbucci and that kind of wanted to do? You see it a lot in like kind of, you know, long filmmakers with like long careers. Hitchcock often used kind of like maybe the same actors, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean,
a lot of directors were quite famous for it, using the same kind of troupe of actors. Is this something that Corbucci would do? Is that a hallmark of his films, would you say? I don't know.
Well, I don't know really, but I would think that because they've got experience and they've performed well in those previous, in the Leone films. So it's like, well, yeah, why not use them again? Because, yeah, like I said, this almost this little kind of troupe of actors for this genre and for the other genres as well in Italian cinema.
No, so, yeah, they've got a good reputation if they perform well. And they all, well, maybe with the exception of Kinski, who could be famously volatile, and they all kind of got along, then perhaps, you know, why not? And especially if some of them seem to have a you know, carved out a better career in Europe than perhaps they would have done in England or in America. So,
absolutely.
With the case of I'm trying not to call him Fred Wolf, Frank Wolf. Sorry.
Could be worse. Could be Scott Wolf.
Yeah, that's true. Wolf with two F's on the end. The case of Frank Wolf. Yeah, who did, you know, who's a bit better known for his work in Italy and elsewhere in Europe. Than certainly in the UK or in America. So.
And where do we go from there? We're right towards the end of the film.
He gets shot and he kind of falls in the ice. Now, one of the strange things I noticed, and it's probably more relevant to when we get to like the ending or the alternate ending. But you don't really see him like drown, do you? You just sort of see him fall in, and that's it.
No.
So.
I mean, it would be a fair assumption that he wouldn't survive that, but obviously it leaves a little gap.
Yeah. But anyway, that's the only thing I wanted to know before we move on.
Yeah. So he goes to his hideout, finds he's got like a hideout with a load of other gang members there. Obviously not the ones that have been killed, which is convenient. Here's some I prepared earlier. And heads back into town. They want to go in and sort of get Silence, basically.
Yeah, and this is where we learn that one of them was had a brother that was killed by Silence.
When he first sort of went to stay with Pauline after she hired him, he was sort of laying down to go to sleep, noticed a candle, and it gave him a flashback to when he was a young man and his parents were killed by Polycott. And and all the rest of it, and when he had his neck cut and everything else. So we've already told you that happens, but that's when in the film we were told. It's about 45 minutes into the film, and then we sort of lead into a final duel, Silence, when he was they go to get sort of well he goes to rape Pollock goes to rape Pauline, while one of his guys sort of attacks Silence, burns his hand on the fire. So he's already weakened. He's been weakened in the bar fight earlier on. He's now got a burnt hand. And whilst he gets, they get Pollica out of there, we're heading towards a duel which Silence is not in the best condition for.
Yeah. So they kill Pollock. He manages to fight off the other guy called Martin, who is the chap who's the big chap who's been in it. Yeah, so he's like, you know, wounded, and they go in looking for him. Paulina hides him.
Yeah,
at the top of the barn, isn't it?
Yeah.
There's only one way this film's going, though, and it is very much that he's going to go out and face them.
Yeah, I don't know if it was because I've seen the film before, but watching it today and getting to about this point, I started to feel really uneasy.
What with what's coming?
Yeah.
Yeah, like, no, I
get
it.
There was a real dread.
I suspect it may have been because you've seen it before, but I can't remember if I read the plot synopsis first, just in case I was having difficulty with any of it. There was a feeling he was going to his death. There was just too much. He was damaged, his hand was hurt, she's trying to stop him.
But that's not, let's say, unheard of in a Western. You can still, like, hear her die, but can still save the day.
Oh yeah, that's the thing. It's kind of on the base. It is the classic Western. The hero is going to stride into town to face down the bad guy. But in previous Westerns, he would save the day. But also, they've said to the outlaws that if you come into town, there's loads of food for you.
Mm.
And so all the outlaws come down, and then they tie them all up, and they put them in the bar.
Yeah.
In the saloon.
There's just logically, I know logic goes out the window and they're all super shots.
Well,
but it would epically have to go out of the window here. There's just too many of them tied up and too many people with guns on him and he's hurt. It just feels like he's going to his execution.
And then they just say, they tell her to tell him, to say, look, if you don't come and face Don Loco, we're going to kill all the outlaws.
Which, again, in line with this film, is what happens anyway. Because that's just what happens all the way through this film. They've been telling people, come out, you'll go to prison, we won't hurt you. And then they kill them anyway.
Yeah.
Kinski's done it once. Apollicut's done it once. You know what I mean? It's just what... It's only Silence who doesn't, but he puts them in a position where they're gonna die. Mm.
Sorry.
I think the only thing was Pauline obviously sort of jumps in for his gun after it happens and tries to fire, and that's the one sort of completely... That's that she didn't need to do that, really. And so she dies, and I'm not sure whether they could have kept... She could have got away. She might have been able to get away, but she's obviously... She probably doesn't want to.
She
probably would have, because there'll be no reason for...
Maybe that was in the alternate happy ending.
Yeah, no reason to kill her. The other outlaws, yeah.
I noticed there was a line early in the film. I think it might have been while they're on the stagecoach with Silence and the sheriff. And the sheriff said to Kinski, I doubt you leave many alive, do you?
He did say that. And I think that's his way of saying that, like, we want proper law and order here, not this sort of kangaroo thing where you go, I'll bring them in, you know, they could be alive, and you know full well they never will be. You're just basically a licensed murderer. That more or less what comes up in the scroll at the end. It says that, you know, this finally provoked outrage at what was effectively legalized murder. The film has been consistent all the way through in what it's trying to tell us.
So it
did kind of spark that change, really, didn't it, as well?
Yeah, because he goes up to the saloon to face Loco. And gets shot by the guy whose brother he killed through another window.
Yeah,
literally through the window.
Which is a form of justice, but it's not a form of injustice that's going to endure.
Yeah, I think we glossed over the fact that he burnt his hand.
Yeah.
I did mention it when I was saying that he was, like, damaged going to the final battle, because he held his hand over the fire.
And, yeah, when he kind of gives, like, one of those, like, silent scream, you can see, like, the excruciating pain on his face. But it just can't...
Yeah, he literally cannot scream out.
Literally, that's for me one of the high points. Like, it must be so hard. I mean, I can't act, but it must be so hard just to kind of emote through, you know, through your eyes or through your facial expressions or something, for you to have like no dialogue whatsoever, not even like, I don't think he even makes a sound, like he doesn't grunt or, you know, just doesn't go, you know, makes any noises.
It's just
eyes. Silent. Literally just through his eyes or through any kind of facial expressions or, you know, looking coolly down the camera or something like that. It must be so hard.
I mean, it's not as much as Sergio Leone did, but there are several close-ups of their eyes, and there's particularly Kinski's as well.
Definitely, yeah, very striking.
And his cold kind of killer eyes.
Definitely, it just you know, it just really because then demonstrated talent that he says so much just with like, I don't know, yeah, looking coolly down the camera, or kind of looking a certain way. Or, I don't know, I was going to say, like, Roger Moore raising an eyebrow. But it's not quite.
Imagine Roger Moore in this. How much pain is he in? Oof! Oh, yeah, quite a bit.
Oof!
He'd have come riding up to the saloon inside a mechanical donkey.
Yeah.
He would have done.
And of course, with a lady. With a
jet plane.
Yeah.
He'd have some kind of glib line with it, wouldn't he, as well? It's just the talent of it, really, to be able to emote, you know, as simply as that, and speak volumes. Likewise, I think it's incredibly. It must be so hard to do that as an actor.
It's a grim film, but it's not. I wouldn't necessarily say it's got a nihilistic air to it.
I don't know. I kind of thought it was a bit nihilistic, but it could.
Yeah, I would agree.
It kind of went like, yeah, that's how it is. Deal with it. It's like, oh, okay.
It didn't feel that grim for most of its running time, though. It felt a tough film. They had a tough environment to endure. But I didn't feel like I was watching something unnecessarily bleak. I don't know. Maybe I'm not explaining that very well.
No, I agree. Well, I understand. But maybe, like I said, maybe when you watch it again, when you know what happens at the end... And it's not going to have the happy ending.
It's kind of odd because I suppose we can kind of talk about the happy ending. Now, for those who... This is on YouTube as well, so you can find it on YouTube.
There's video of alternate endings.
The one where he says, frankly, my dear, let's get married.
Yes.
Buy an American car.
Now, essentially what happens to the happy ending is the direct opposite, like, literally the direct opposite. Like,
what, they suck bullets out of him.
Yes. the sheriff, he comes out of nowhere. He's not shot in the hand or anything coming to. Loco appears at the entrance of the bar, and they're about to draw, but then. The sheriff actually turns up, so he's actually not drowned, and then shoots Loco, and then he draws a gun and shoots all the other guys with his Mauser, and then everyone's freed. It's like, hey, you know, and you're my new deputy, and everyone's happy, and it's all just marvellous.
and the Evil Dead did himself, hasn't he, with his hand?
Yes. So he's got, that's one thing I wasn't sure, because he's like, it's like I've got a metal glove or something. So I don't know if that was, I'm not sure, because that was like, his hand was burnt. I was like, well, what's that going to do for you? But, I mean, I that was the only thing I wasn't too sure about.
Yeah.
I was like.
Well, he's got the reputation of shooting with his hands, hasn't he? So maybe it was kind of, I don't know.
Well, it was ridiculous, and it was.
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit. I mean, that's what made me sort of think about it, because it's, you know, because the downbeat ending seems more consistent.
Yeah.
Now, I think with the ending, because it's because it plays, it's so kind of cheesy. I don't know. That's what's kind of interesting with the returns of, like, we don't really see the sheriff drown. It's kind of left as almost if to say, oh, you might come back, and then the rest of the movie carries on. And so it does kind of make sense for him to turn up again out of nowhere. But then, do you know what I mean? So I do wonder whether, like, they had this in mind originally, but because it's like, it played off a bit like, this is a bit goofy. Let's try that. Let's how about if the bad guys win and it just plays better? I don't know.
I always thought it was reshoots, to be honest with you. I say always. I didn't know about this film very long ago, but the bits I've read in the last few days before watching it properly today, that's what I'm saying. I sort of knew what was coming in some cases, and I knew that there were alternate endings done. And I tried to read it without reading it, in that glossing over bits that would spoil anything, but aware that there's good and bad endings. And I remember reading something along the lines of the studio weren't happy and were refusing to release it in certain territories unless they changed that ending. Now, whether they could do it with existing footage shot and they'd already hedged their bets, or whether they physically had to reshoot, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not too sure about that one, actually. Yeah, I don't know. Listeners, if you know, please let us know. Get in touch, tweet us, message us on Facebook, send us an email, spokestalk@gmail.com. Share your knowledge.
But, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I suppose it would be interesting to see a cut with the actual happy ending, just see how that feels. Because you can only rewatch it separately, can't you?
That's true.
Yeah, you can't watch the whole film and then...
That's true.
Yeah.
Because most of the time, these alternate endings are not alternate endings at all. It's where the film was cut for an international audience, and it finishes just a bit earlier. So yeah. You know, we'll see that next week, where a certain character doesn't die because the film ended before he died. And we'll obviously cover that next week. But any other final thoughts, folks?
No, just that it's one that's going to be that I'm going to rewatch. I think like Dave is, because I've got the Blu-ray anyway, so I'm going to revisit it at some point. But yeah, it's going to be definitely one I'm going to watch again for sure.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you, Charlie, for recommending it. Definitely, I think it's all made our lives a little richer, and certainly helped grow my appreciation of the genre.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'm probably going to try and see if I can. See where I can get the best deal, and try and pick up this Blu-ray release, definitely. So yeah.
Would you say it's like one of the? Would you say it's the grimmest ending to a film, or would you like? Would you put it? Where would you put it? Like. Ooh. Do you think there's a hard question.
There's a lot of films out there, isn't there? Aren't there?
There is. Yeah. And you've got a lot of adaptations of like Shakespeare tragedies as well, where everybody dies at the end.
It's the one I keep thinking of as a myth.
See, that's why it's so nihilistic, because everyone dies in the end.
Everyone dies at the end of The Perfect Storm. You spend 2 hours watching them try and save their life, and they all die.
Oh, God, that's
very sad. Yeah.
Well, they all die, Chris. I'm glad. I hope I didn't spoil it for you. 22 years later.
What film was that? Anyway.
The Perfect Storm.
Oh, okay.
The Wolfgang Peterson, the boat film with Clooney and Wahlberg. I wasn't even thinking of it particularly as a classic, but it was one that sprung to mind where, like, everyone dies at the end. That matters. Yeah. That matters in the film.
Or like Shakespearean tragedy, where everybody does die. Yeah.
I was thinking of Night of the Living Dead.
Yeah.
Well, they're all got to at the end, aren't they? Yeah.
Well, at the end, there's the African American character who's been defending them all, who gets shot by people. Whoever I'm hunting for zombies, rednecks.
Yeah, literally.
And it shows him being pulled away, and they're using hooks to carry his body because they didn't want to touch it.
Yeah.
And that was the same year as well, 68.
Yeah.
They think he was a zombie, didn't they? It's like just.
It's just the racism.
Yeah.
Well.
Because he was black.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was all. Again, yeah, it was all during that time of sort of a lot of social upheaval, a lot of political unrest and everything as well. So obviously, sort of looking at it through the prism of Westerns, you're looking at it through the prism of.
Yeah, a lot of riots and assassinations and racial tensions around this time. Yeah, absolutely.
Mm, definitely.
Yeah. Thank God that's all sorted now completely.
Yeah, thank God we've moved on.
What I thought was like The Mist. That was like the.
That I haven't seen. I know who's involved with it. I know what it is. I've never actually got around to it.
All right. Do you know the ending?
Yes.
Yes. That's a grim end.
Yeah.
But, funnily enough, it does have a bit of a positive message, even though it's really grim. But, it is really, really... Well,
right. Weather's better tomorrow. Weather forecast looks good now.
Yeah, well, I mean, I would say that there is, like, there is a message of hope, like, don't give up, which is exactly the opposite of what the characters did.
Yeah.
But, it does it in a really grim way.
If we thought about it long enough... The cast dying, particularly in war films and things like that, wouldn't be that rare. wouldn't be no. as rare as you would think. But it's probably rare in this genre.
It's like disaster films, and even sort of sense some horror, because it's, in a way, you kind of expect some endings like that. You know,
well, certainly disaster films, some of them die.
Yeah, whereas this, for example, you expect the direct opposite. So when you get this ending, it's a bit more like, oh my god.
I would have found it less traumatizing if Shelley Winters just was the one in everyone. Just Shelley Winters has a heart attack in every disaster film, and then you can relax. Nothing bad's going to happen. I don't feel I've got the most out of this film, though, Chris.
No.
I don't know why that is. I think it's because it's called The Great Silence. It made me think of The Great Soprendo, so I thought it would be someone doing magic tricks for children. But Charlie said in the snow. So I thought it might be magic tricks where, I don't know, he hid things in snow. And it wasn't, which makes me a bit embarrassed that I don't know anything.
I think we need someone to read stuff on IMDb trivia to inform us.
As long as they sound like they came up with it themselves.
Oh, of course.
All right, factors.
I think that's what I'll have to do, because I am underprepared. I kind of thought, oh no, you guys and Charlie will provide the expert knowledge. So I will go in.
Well, hang on a minute. Then I think, to finish my thought there, I think I get the most out of this film by remaining completely uninformed. What about you, Chris?
Well, if you want to find out more, yeah, I recommend buying the Masters of Cinema release.
Did I steal your only fun fact?
No, I literally hadn't got around to it. I kind of thought, because what usually happens, you guys, I'll do my introduction bit, I'll come in when prompted, and then you guys take the floor, and I'll just be like in the background, quick, do fun facts, or I'll typing away in the background. But I haven't done that tonight. I've tried to engage a little bit more.
Yeah, no, I did notice that you were kind of really, really engaged, which is
I don't mean to be rude. I do apologise. It's a new film to me, and I really enjoyed it.
I have kind of a fact. I mean, it's not really a fact, it's more of a tribute. Well, it's true, but it's like, Clint Eastwood wanted to do an English version of this.
An English version?
Really?
Top of the morning to you. Very sparky today, isn't it?
He wants to do his version of it with him playing Silas.
But set in Humberside.
yeah.
Oh, bloody parky this morning.
Isn't that basically Get Carter, but like sort of bleak industrial, post-industrial landscape? Although having said that, it's interesting. Like, if you do go on IMDb.com, and one of the facts is remade as a Japanese samurai TV series. So obviously it was inspired by Yojimbo, made into Western or
at least we know the lead wouldn't have had any problems learning his lines every week.
No, that's it. You got no lines to learn. So it was inspired by sort of Japanese samurai epic, made as a post spaghetti Western, or post as an anti-Western, and then it was again remade as a Japanese samurai series. So I think that's kind of interesting. It's been through the
with Seven Samurai and A Fistful of Dollars. Sorry, Yojimbo and A Fistful of Dollars. And Seven Samurai and The Magnificent Seven.
Yeah.
That's the one, exactly. They've been through that Western washing machine.
Yeah, I know one fun fact that is about as fun... Well, it's probably the fun element is probably suitable for this film, is that Klaus Kinski apparently... had a fight with Frank Wolf.
Oh, really?
Because Frank Wolf was Jewish, and Klaus Kinski said that because he was German, he hated all Jewish people.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Oh, dear.
Awkward.
Speaking of Clint Eastwood, Pauline Vanetta McGee did go on to be in the Eiger Sanction from 1975 with him, and she was in Repo Man.
She was in Black Exploitation films. Because I recognised her.
Directed by Alex Cox.
It was one of the Shaft sequels I've seen her in.
Yeah, Shaft in Africa.
Yeah.
That's where I've seen her before. Yeah.
And she was in Blackula.
Why does she look so familiar?
Blackula. See, the reason I said Shaft in Africa is I try to only speak where I'm sure, and I'm sure I've seen Shaft in Africa. I'm only about 51% sure I've seen Blackula. I don't know if it's so familiar to me that I haven't actually seen it, but I think I
have. She's in Cagney and Lacey. Oh my god.
I don't know if it's still in print, but Blackula, the Masters of Cinema, did a great DVD, Blu-ray, sorry, of Blackula and the sequel, which I think is Blackula Screams Again.
Oh, it probably is. It'll probably still be out there.
Blackula, the complete collection, dual format, Blu-ray.
Cool.
That is, let me look.
I think we're sponsored by Masters of Cinema tonight,
awesome,
aren't we?
Yeah, Pam Grier's in it.
Legend.
Hang on a second. I want to see if this is Masters. Am I looking at the same thing? Yeah, it's got a 32-page booklet. That looks like Masters of Cinema to me. Yeah, Introduction by Kim Newman. That's a Masters of Cinema release.
Oh, Kim Newman.
Yeah, it's still in print. That's nice because
£11.45. That's not outrageous.
No, the two films exactly, and it's different because these films sometimes. Because of rights and whatever, and they go out of print sometimes, and it's difficult to
get them back into print for that reason. You had this window to do it. It's bringing up Foxy Brown, Black Mamma, White Mamma, and it's bringing up some Italian horrors as well in the suggestions.
Mm.
Awesome. Okay. All right. Well, if we've been facted as much as we're going to be facted, you can find me at ThePastyKid 1976 on Twitter.
That's fact, folks. You can find me at CineTrots on Twitter. You can find this podcast on Podbean.
And you can find the Catherine Bigelow film, Detroit, on Amazon Prime while I'm looking at it.
Cool.
My favourite film of that year, 2017, or what it was, I think.
Okie dokie. Mm. And guys, if you want to check out this film, The Great Silence, it's now available from Masters of Cinema, but you can also watch it on YouTube for free, and it's also available to stream on Prime and other good services. If you want to check us out, we are Do You Expect Us to Talk. You can find us on Facebook, Do You Expect Us to Talk, on Twitter at Expect Us to Talk, on YouTube just search Do You Expect Us to Talk and you can find us all on there. All the series that we've done so far are on there, but whatever platform you listen to us on, don't forget to rate us, review us, to like us and share us on your podcatcher of choice. Helps us to rank higher and attract more listeners. If you're listening to us, just pop a little status update on your socials, say I'm listening to you, Do You Expect Us to Talk, just share that status and hopefully you've got other people listening to us as well.
So you can find me on Twitter at Films on Wax.
Okay, so we're back online. That's two in about 2 weeks by the time we release this, so we're on fire. We're going to go back to Sergio Leone next. I actually, for some reason, even though I've known this film really well, I think it's because I'm on Her Majesty's Secret Service is my favourite Bond film. I think I erroneously thought that was the one we're going to do is 1969. It's actually listed as 68. But whether it was released in this country a bit late, so same year as this, but you can debate which one was first. But we are back for another Leone, and I unabashedly say it's my favourite, which means Becca.
Yes, so we'll return with Once Upon a Time in the West.